okay? All right, Karen?
Okay, just going to jump in due to time limitations. So my presentation is titled The Ungovernable Spaces of Security. And during periods of war, danger, panic, or emergency, exceptional measures initiated by governments suspend the normal functioning of law. Giorgio Agamben defines this as a state of exception, a phenomenon he assumes to be indicative of sovereignty. He argues that it is in the very act by which the state annuls its own laws that the operation of sovereign power emerges. He further maintains that the most dangerous possibility for the state of exception is when it is granted permanent spatial arrangement. He thus identifies the concentration camp as the ultimate representative space that operates outside of the rule of law, with the consequence of abandoning and devaluing subjects and reducing them to bare life, a condition where the individual is suspended between life and death. Without legal protections, the camp is the ultimate space without law, and bare life is produced through arbitrary executive actions of the state. What is at stake in Agamben's analysis of the state of exception, and the primary theme of this discussion, is the creation and definition of spaces through which sovereign power can have validity. So the question for today is exploring other manifestations of the state of exception outside of the camp. The contemporary emphasis on protecting national security in at least Western legal and political discourses, and especially after the 9/11 attacks, leaves emerging forms of regulation traversing both traditional legal forms of governance as well as national boundaries. Focusing on post-9/11 changes in security, I'm challenging the idea then that enclosed, bounded, or physical spaces can be the only locations for sovereignty to operate. Therefore, I aim to expand Agamben's ideas regarding the state of exception by considering the possibility for sovereignty's emergence in variable spatial contexts, including physical spaces, digital spaces, and moral spaces. So the first one is physical spaces, and this corresponds most closely to Agamben's idea that example of the concentration camp is the political space where the state of exception acts normally. Certain forms of detention practices emerging in the last few years expose parallels to Agamben's idea of enclosed sovereign spaces. In Canada, detention centers are most often located at points of entry, including airports, marine ports, and borders. Immigration officers are now authorized to arrest foreign nationals or permanent residents who have or who may have breached the new Immigration and Refugee Protection Act that was implemented in June 2002. Individuals can be arrested and detained if they are believed to pose a danger to the public, if their identity is in question, or if there is reason to believe that they will not appear for immigration proceedings. Upon arrest, they are interviewed, fingerprinted, and photographed, and their original travel documents are seized, after which authorities can decide whether to continue detention or to release the person with or without conditions. If the person is not released, a member of the Immigration Division reviews the case in 7 days and then every subsequent 30 days. So the decision to arrest, detain, and if necessary, remove foreign nationals from Canada indicates a suspension of law, first of all, in the risk factors used to determine whether individuals are, in fact, threats to security. Such risk factors are both created and deployed by state officials, making the manufacture and execution of regulation the responsibility of the same political institutions and officials. The detention center thus becomes a lawless space when individuals are arrested and detained without having been accused of any particular crime. Unlike individuals in prisons who have been judged and sentenced through legal channels based on rule of law, those held under the premise of national security are held under the pretense of preventive or administrative detention. The detained subject or the detainee is not granted a specific sentence but can be detained indefinitely based upon the expedience of the review process. Another significant point to highlight regarding the arrest and detention process is that these practices primarily operate at points of entry into Canada. These locations themselves predispose certain individuals as targets, whether it be permanent residents, foreign nationals, travelers, or refugee claimants. Pratt refers to this as immigration penality, a form of regulation that constitutes and enforces points of entry, polices non-citizens, identifies those deemed dangerous, deceitful, or destitute, and refuses them entry or casts them out. She argues that the specific practice of detention and deportation are two of the extreme and bodily sanctions associated with national security practices. However, what is interesting in this point is that although these practices do not necessarily suspend the individual between life and death, as the notion of bare life implies, they do provide the grounds to extend the idea of suspension away from life to identity. That is, rather than being suspended between life and death, the detained individual is suspended between having a national identity and being stateless. Thus, while the actual detention center produces the spatial distinction of inside and outside, insider, outsider, its location at points of entry points of entry simultaneously constitute a spatial threshold that suspends the identity of individuals. So far we've seen how the issue of detention centers ties rather closely to Agamben's idea that sovereignty operates in an enclosed space, physical space. However, he does not go on to imagine if or how sovereign power functions differentially or simultaneously to target certain populations. Particularly after 9/11, many external partners have been drawn into the ever-increasing regulatory apparatus. The new powers granted to immigration officers in the previous example illustrate only one way the rule of law has been suspended, through the deferral of power to agencies that have been traditionally uninvolved in legal or judicial forms of regulation. This extension of sovereignty applies to other public and private agencies as well, including civil, humanitarian, and financial agencies, departments involved in foreign affairs, transportation, defense, and the environment, as well as emergency services and healthcare. Each of these new partners has been delegated responsibilities to either monitor, share information about, turn in, or incarcerate individuals, all under the common goal of protecting the nation. Consequently, the diversification and multiplication of physical spaces creates compartments of sovereignty that diffuse regulatory powers away from traditional judicial channels, such as police agencies and courts, and into diverse extra-legal realms of accountability. Okay, so to get into the next phase, which I've called digital spaces, the current emphasis on tactics such as information sharing, intelligence gathering, and racial profiling suggests that the state of exception might also operate digitally. And to investigate this possibility, I briefly turn to Deleuze's notion of control societies in order to reframe Agamben's ideas on sovereignty. Deleuze argues that in a control society, one no longer physically moves from one close site to the other, but is increasingly subject to free-floating, sporadic forms of control. Control societies are defined by a numerical language that reconceives the individual and the mass based on access or denial to information. Individuals thus become individuals or data representations, and masses become information banks. This vision of society also necessarily transforms the idea of sovereignty away from power confined within institutions of enclosure to that which is deterritorialized or decentered. The question then becomes if it is possible for the state of exception to operate digitally, and if so, how? While there are obviously no clear answers to this question, my hypothesis at this point would be that in a security context, sovereignty infuses the information sharing practices deemed necessary to forge interagency collaborations. Particularly under the premise of an unclear enemy such as terrorism, the perceived necessity of information from an abundance of diverse sources constitutes the state of exception into a technological phenomenon. The suspension of law exists in the transition of political power away from the state and into technologies, a phenomenon that Paul Virilio has also discussed. He calls it pure war, or war that is executed in the infinite preparation of scientific and technological preparation, whereby the main weapon is the weaponry of communication. So both Deleuze and Virilio's ideas resonate somewhat with the rationale behind Canada's main security agency, CSIS, or the Canadian Security Intelligence Service, whom states that its efficiency as an agency depends on the magnitude of external sources to inform, guide, support, and validate the profiles of security threats that they produce. Information sharing is the central mechanism determining the cycle of treatment, documentation, and passage of information between agencies. Databases store, analyze, reconfigure, and transform information through increasingly complex computer systems and databases. Once information is processed, various information and profiles are disseminated back to relevant law enforcement and other external partners. For CSIS, information sharing and profiling becomes the tactic both constructing the identity of the threat and determining the guidelines on how to react and respond. Those with the proper passwords to access certain data sources are therefore in crucial positions to execute control through the technological venues of computers and computer systems. The ongoing rapid circulation of information within and between agencies also produces the sovereign subjects as malleable profiles that alternate based on the analysis and synthesis of data. As opposed to the idea of a physical bound space, a digitized state of exception might operate fluidly through mobile channels of information to produce malleable subjects in the form of information profiles. If we can assume that a digital state of exception is possible, then perhaps the idea of bare life might no longer apply. Or if it does, it no longer refers to the suspension between life and death, but rather the suspension between biological and digital, or fixed and malleable conceptions of the body, the individual, or the group. Okay, so my last point is the final idea I'm looking at is the idea of moral spaces. And Shapiro defines moral spaces as, quote, the bounded locations whose inhabitants acquire the privileges deriving from ethical inclusion and on the need to intervene in the dominant practices of intelligibility that enable geopolitical imaginaries. So with regard to the state of exception, I am interpreting moral spaces to be the ethical decision-making practices that define and decide who is protected by law and who is excluded from these protections. The idea of moral spaces brings attention to the possibility of conceiving the state of exception in terms of rhetorical or discursive productions. Therefore, locating sovereignty requires analyzing the rhetorical devices used in political discourses to define the threats and enemies. Butler contends that, quote, the more speech can produce equivocation, the more effectively it can augment power in the apparent service of justice, a phenomenon that others have deemed reason of the strongest. What appears to be one of the most obvious rhetorical devices deployed in recent political discourses is associating the notion of terrorist or threat to security as being somehow foreign to Canada and Canadian ways of being. In a statement released from the Department of Public Safety and Emergency Preparedness, for instance, they argued that the best way to stop terrorists from entering Canada is to stop them before they get here, and that many of the real and direct threats to Canada originate from far beyond our borders. However, rhetorical strategies do not only operate to exclude individuals and groups based on such obvious exclusionary designations such as threats to security. They also operate on a more subtle level, even embedded in the legislations produced to govern these threats, and often in the form of distinguishing types of individuals from one another. Security certificates, a controversial measure in itself, is one example where the Minister of Citizenship and Immigration Canada can issue a certificate based on any suspicion that an individual poses a threat to security. What happens to the individual once the certificate is signed, however, varies with the individual's immigrant status. Refugees are immediately detained without a warrant, while permanent residents can be detained only if a warrant is issued, and only on the grounds that he or she is a danger to security or is unlikely to show up for an immigration hearing. Political discourses, therefore, not only formulate who the threat is, linking it often to foreigners specifically and foreignness generally, but also further discriminate the ability to access legal protections based on the level of belongingness to Canada. In this case, the degree of statelessness inversely relates to legal status. That is, the less stable one's immigration status as a Canadian citizen, the further outside the rule of law one is placed. So within the moral spaces of discourse, identity categories are forged for the purpose of designating the legal status of individuals as either protected or removed from the rule of law. Edward Syed notes, in quote, the power to narrate or to block other narratives from forming and emerging constitutes one of the primary mechanisms of the imperialist violence involved in monological cultural encounters, end quote. So regarding the state of exception, then, law appears to be suspended in the moment of enunciation in the rhetorical devices that compose discourses, and therefore sovereign power extends itself through narration or acts of speech. So in conclusion, I've attempted to consider how Agamben's ideas on sovereignty and the state of exception are contingent upon various practical and conceptual spaces. This is not to say that variations in spatial context produce distinct meanings or emergences of sovereignty, only that the state of exception has no singular meaning, nor does it occupy any one particular space. Rather, the state of exception and its suspension of law appear contingent upon the spatial context it both occupies and produces. In attempting to understand, enlarge, and traverse Agamben's ideas, however, I end with some unanswered questions. It's our time. I just have three. Okay. Okay. So first, can systems based on law and democracy only emerge from or after state of emergency, therefore making the state of emergency the precondition for something like democracy? Second is, how is it that judicial and legal forms of knowledge are so easily overlooked in emergency circumstances, and why are executive and administrative forms of knowledge immediately considered expert in those circumstances? And finally, does this mean that legal systems based on rule of law are designated to only function within the limits of order, and that they do not have the capacities or proper channels to handle anything disrupting normative conditions?